You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome along to the latest episode of the Manchester Is Red podcast. I'm today's host, George Smith, and I'm delighted to be joined this Wednesday lunchtime by my colleague, Tyrone Marshall. Ty, how are you?
Yes, good. Thank you, George. Good. Looking forward to getting stuck into a bit of United stuff, and listeners will be pleased to know we will do our best not to talk about the derby. I think Samuel and Stephen covered that in gruesome detail on Monday, and I'm sure nobody wants to talk about it ever again of a red persuasion in Manchester.
Yeah, I think the ship sailed on that one. So we'll try and look forward, try and be as positive as we can and look ahead to what could be coming round the corner. Obviously, the Everton game on Saturday, but Samuel and Stephen will preview that more in depth later in the week. But coming up on today's show, we're going to reflect on quite a big revealing interview that's been conducted by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, analyse United's top four hopes in the wider race for a top four finish, and what this summer could potentially look like at Old Trafford as well. But first, Ty, I think it's important we start with this Ole Gunnar Solskjaer interview that has been released this morning, Wednesday morning, as we do this. He's opened up on quite a wide range of topics, such as recruitment, missing out on Erling Haaland, Declan Rice, Cristiano Ronaldo's second spell at Old Trafford, and a lot more. But I think the headline act of this interview, Ty, certainly from my persuasion anyway, is the fact that he's quite revealed a little bit. It was obviously fairly obvious already, but Erling Haaland was a player that United could have signed. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer told them about his potential, his quality. They could have had him for a €20 million release clause. We've all seen what he's achieved in Manchester, albeit in the blue half of the city. And I think this just about summarises where United have gone wrong in the last 10, 11 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they should have been aware by heart of Haaland at that point. I think at that stage, when he just signed for Salzburg, most elite clubs in Europe were aware of his potential, of how good he was. And for whatever reason, they didn't make their move. Solskjaer clearly wanted to sign him. You know, he's raised this topic of Haaland before. I do think it's one of those that is you know, it's the manager's point of view. It's Solskjaer kind of, I don't know if deflecting blame is the right way to put it, but it's like, you know, this is what I could have done. I wanted Rice, I wanted Haaland, I wanted Bellingham. Like, well, of course he did. Everyone did, really. But it's not always as simple as that. We don't know exactly what happened in that phase, but certainly they could have gone for him sooner. I think there's always the possibility that Haaland could have represented United. But the reality is, in the end, they left it too long. And, you know, I think one of the biggest takeaways from this sort of stuff, and the same with Solskjaer when he's done interviews previously, is players like Bellingham and Haaland, 20, 25 years ago, it would have been unthinkable for players of that quality, young English players, if United wanted them, that they wouldn't end up at Old Trafford. Now, I don't think Haaland or Bellingham will ever play for United, and I don't think it's going to damage their career in the slightest that they never play for United. And that is damning of where United are. By the time United were pushing for him in that January window, he went to Dortmund, the move to Dortmund was a more attractive option. Same with Bellingham. And, you know, you look at United and it's an unstable, poorly run football club with no great recent track record of success. So if you're going to sign players like Haaland and Bellingham and maybe even Rice, you need to get in before the rest do, basically. And that's probably what Solskjaer was recommending.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, Haaland's kicked on to unbelievable levels at City. Jude Bellingham's been immense for Real Madrid this season. But it's just, it's a case of, you look at the players that United, that Solskjaer in particular wanted, your Haalands, your Bellinghams, your Declan Rices. These were elite level players that were destined for the top at that point when United were interested. And it just feels like Erling Haaland, obviously being known to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well, he'd worked with him at Molde for €20 million. It would have been the bargain of the century if United had got that done. But as Solskjaer said himself, it was the club's decision not to go for him. He recommended him immediately as he walked through the door.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the club, for whatever reason, decided not to. The transfer record over the last decade has been disastrous, really. The wrong people have been making decisions. it's something Ineos is trying to sort now. You know, it's a difficult one to know what exactly United scouting reports were at that stage. No other club was trying to sign him at that stage. He had just gone from Molde to Salzburg. It was at Salzburg, I guess, where he went to the next level. But Solskjaer clearly saw that potential. And like you say, for 20 million, it's a decent fee for someone who had only ever played in Norway and was still very young at the time. But you know, I think he would have been on the radar of United, certainly. And it was probably a gamble worth taking because, like you say, when they did go for him, it was too late. And now he's playing for City, he's doing damage for United. And I was at his press conference yesterday when it was the press conference of a superstar, essentially. There was essentially a meaningless Champions League last 16 second leg tie and City putting Haaland up, and suddenly the world and his dog are inside their press auditorium and Haaland just greets every question with a smile. He could be surly at Dortmund, but he was brilliant yesterday and he was asked about his future and kind of left the door open by saying, and he knew it was going to cause a headline as soon as he said it, but said, you never know what's going to come in the future. I don't think it's any secret that he doesn't see his career as being 15 years at one club. He sees his career as moving around and playing for a few elite clubs, but that ain't going to include United. If he leaves, it's going to be to Real Madrid. There's no chance that Erling Haaland will ever play for Manchester United now.
You certainly wouldn't think so, but I think Declan Rice as well is another really interesting one. And I think it's interesting in particular in the fact that United, as this summer approaches, are probably going to be in the market for another defensive midfield player. Casemiro has regressed remarkably this season. It's been quite staggering, really, considering how good he was last year. But Declan Rice, he was another player that United wanted a long time before Arsenal got him last summer. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer admitted in this interview that he regretted not being able to get him. United probably would have been able to get him for a little bit less, perhaps, than what Arsenal paid last summer if they'd signed him 2-3 years earlier, because obviously his stock's been on the rise in that period. But Declan Rice, he would have been a signing for the long term, and he's taken his game to a whole new level this season. Obviously, Erling Haaland would have provided the goals, but Declan Rice, he could have been the glue and the makeup of that team for years to come, sort of pieced around him.
Yeah, absolutely. And, everyone's been saying United need to sign Rice, but for years and years, when they signed Casemiro, it was a holding midfielder that they badly needed. And Rice can do that role, but at Arsenal, he's probably helped now with Jorginho playing there, that he can play further forward as well. And what a player. I mean, he's been absolutely incredible for Arsenal in the last few weeks. And I think the last two or three, maybe, games that he played for West Ham at Old Trafford, he was the best midfielder on the pitch every single time. Every single time you came away from that game and your follow-up was, Declan Rice is the midfielder United need. And They never did make it happen. They should have done. They should have been in the market for him again this year. They've spent 55 million on Mason Mount, who, all right, he's been injured, but he was poor at the start of the season. He just doesn't have a role in that midfield anymore. Kobbie Mainoo is a better player, I think, already than Mason Mount. I don't see where Mason Mount plays. They spent 70 million on Casemiro. It was a short-term signing. It's probably going to be more short-term than anyone expected. He's on massive wages. They spent 10 million on just bringing Sofyan Amrabat in on loan. They could have signed, they could have signed none of those players and just spent 100 million on Declan Rice, and they'd have been in a better position than signing those three players, I think. And Rice is the type of player they should have gone 4 years ago. It's the type of player United have a history of going for, really. The best players in the Premier League at clubs that aren't, say, Liverpool or City or Arsenal are the ones United should be targeting. But feels quite telling that those sort of players go to Arsenal now or go to Liverpool in Van Dijk's case, or they go to City. They don't go to Manchester United. And it's where the club have been going wrong in the transfer market over the last 10 years. But I also think that there's got to be a dose of realism here. They aren't the prospect of players that they were 10, 15 years ago. I mean, Rice is a bit older, but you talk of Haaland and Bellingham. Barely got any recollection of Manchester United being a successful football team. If United were trying to sign a world-class 18-year-old now, all that kid really is known is a mediocre mess of a Manchester United. So they've got a big name, they've got a grand history, but most players don't really care about that. They want to know what the club is like at the moment. And the reality for United is they are not a particularly attractive proposition if Arsenal or Liverpool or Manchester City are in for the same player. And that's something that Ineos have got to sort out.
Yeah, definitely. And as we've seen this season, the league table doesn't lie. It tells you the gulf between those three or four clubs that you've mentioned there. But you think, obviously, Jude Bellingham, Declan Rice, two players that United have wanted in the past. Harry Kane was another one last summer. So effectively the spine of the England national team. But United were never going to stand a chance, as you've said. But I think, obviously, Ineos coming in, it is going to be a point now where the recruitment direction's got to change. Omar Berada's come in. Dan Ashworth could be coming in as well. It's going to be a major, major change in the makeup of that boardroom and how it's going to progress forward thinking. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has actually said that even though gradually he tried to change the direction of recruitment at the club, and there was perhaps instances of that. Signing Jadon Sancho was a young upcoming player, and we all know that's not worked out at all. So you sort of sense with the players that Solskjaer identified, he did want to do that with younger players who had got high potential. But like you said, every man and his dog wanted those players.
Yeah, absolutely. And Solskjaer wanted Sancho for two consecutive summers, yet was surprised when he signed at what wing he wanted to play on. It doesn't suggest a great deal of research has gone into that or conversations with the player. We all know about his background at Borussia Dortmund. He was late at Borussia Dortmund. He wasn't an easy character at Dortmund. He's carried those traits on to United. So it was a very exciting signing at the time, but I guess the red flags were there. It was a club that was kind of lacking that leadership. I mean, there was a time where Mike Phelan was essentially director of football there. He was assistant manager while pulling the strings in the background, and it just wasn't going to work. And things have had to change. We've seen it now with Ten Hag. He has got what he wanted in the transfer market, basically. And even last week he was saying he still wants control. I just don't think it's realistic, really. And the biggest red flag against that is Antony. And the two of them are inextricably linked, really, indelibly linked. It's hard to envisage. I mean, Ten Hag barely wants Antony at the moment, given how rarely he plays him. And if he was to be replaced this summer, it's hard to believe any other manager would want Antony, but they're basically stuck with him. So they do need this structure. They need this structure with a proper sporting director with a clear vision in charge there. You just hope they get the structure right. There seems to be a lot of job titles that are kind of floating around. They're looking to bring in Wilcox, obviously. This, from what I've been told, it's potentially a couple of others as well that they're going to bring into this structure. That's a lot of cooks. Sometimes you don't need that many. I mean, City haven't got that many people pulling the strings, and they're pretty good. Liverpool the same. I don't think they've got that many staff there. They haven't got a technical director and a performance director and a sporting director and a football director and a recruitment director and all this sort of thing. So you just hope they don't overdo it in terms of recruiting staff, because that's what Chelsea have done, and it's not worked for Chelsea. Chelsea are bringing in new football executives every couple of months, normally from Brighton, but there's still no sign of a clear vision there or any kind of joined up thinking. But it's definitely an improvement on what's gone before.
No, you're absolutely right. And it takes you back actually to a quote I think Erik ten Hag said, certainly towards the very, very end of last season, where he said you can have all the money in the world basically, but with no philosophy or structure behind it, it is pretty meaningless. And I think that was perhaps a slight dig at the way Chelsea had splashed the cash and not really gone anywhere, and that's been the case again this season for them. But of course, United, whoever they have at the top table this summer, they are going to, of course, want these elite-level players. But the chances are your Cities, your Liverpools, your Bayern Munichs, your Real Madrids are going to want them as well, and they still remain far better prospects, because United at the minute, as we're going to discuss later on, potentially are going to miss out on Champions League football next season.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will come on to it, but it's also a case that United cannot afford those players. Ten Hag was desperate for a striker in January. They just couldn't afford one. They couldn't even afford another Vuk Veghorst like type loan deal. They just did not have a penny to spend. And, they are tight on Premier League spending rules. We've seen what's happened with Forest and Everton. You don't want to breach those rules, so United aren't going to breach them. But it does mean they just don't have a lot of money to spend at all. And if they miss out on the Champions League, I think their budget's going to be small in the summer, unless they sell a McTominay or a Rashford or something stark like that to raise some funds. I just think if they miss out on the Champions League, it's going to be a really difficult summer for the new structure.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Erik ten Hag as well last season warned that Champions League qualification was so key in being part of a sales pitch to bring any player to the club. And Sir Jim Ratcliffe's already warned, hasn't he, about the pitfalls and the damage that missing out on the Champions League could do financially. And that is going to be a major, major problem for the club if they can't secure that place in Europe's Premier Club competition. So however Ten Hag, whoever the manager may be at United this summer, if without Champions League football, it's going to be a really hard sell.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, it's not just, you know, talking about the financial element there, but like you're right, it's not just that. It's the prestige as well. And the problem for United is that they're in the Champions League so rarely this season. I mean, I think they've been in twice, maybe back to back since Ferguson retired. They're almost certainly going to miss out again. You know, it's a rarity. Not a rarity, but it's almost like every other year they're in the Champions League. They qualify for the Champions League. Then they have a year in the Europa League. When they do get in the Champions League, they make absolutely no impact. They go out of the group stage or they go out the last 16 stage. They've won two knockout ties, I think, in 11 years now against Olympiakos and against Paris Saint-Germain. You know, they just don't win games against good teams in the Champions League, and they haven't done for over a decade. And that doesn't make them an attractive position to appear. And anyone looking is going to think, well, they might get in the Champions League, but they've shown no signs that they can A, make an impact in it, or B, become a regular fixture in it year after year.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, they've played six matches in the Champions League in two seasons. And they were in a relatively favourable group, I think we can agree, this season. Obviously, Bayern Munich, the exception, but Copenhagen, Galatasaray, they should have been escaping that group. Certainly in second place behind Bayern, you would have liked to have think. But they were obviously nowhere near good enough. They managed one win in them six games. And that, again, like you said there, it just highlights how far away this club is from wanting to be the elite level club it used to be. So it's going to be a hard sell in the summer, there's no doubt about that. But you almost have to think at the same time, Ineos, they're trying their damnedest to get things in place to make things work. But without the Champions League element, it's just going to make the task 10 times harder, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to slow them down considerably. You know, I guess it's hard to put a time frame on it, but it's almost like it's a catch-22, where it becomes a recurring nightmare almost, that they miss out on the Champions League. They can't spend what they want on the squad. They go in again with a squad not capable of getting to the Champions League next year. They miss out again. They can't spend what they want again. You know, it's one of these cycles that you just can't get out of. And I think there's probably a nucleus of a squad there that is capable of getting in the top four. But the competition for that in the Premier League is intense. The top three spots feel like they're sewn up. Certainly this year, probably next year. You know, we don't know with Liverpool, with Klopp leaving, but you can't imagine that it's going to affect them so badly they'll fall out of the top four, given the quality of that squad. And then, you know, Tottenham are improving under Postecoglou. Newcastle will surely keep on improving. Villa have been doing great under Emery. Chelsea are just going to keep spending until presumably at some point they will get it right. So there's just no guarantee. You think back to that spell where, you know, what we're talking like sort of 2005 onwards, 2004 onwards maybe, where it was a big four and the same four clubs qualified for the Champions League pretty much every year. I mean, that just doesn't happen now. And there's no guarantee at the start of the season for clubs of sort of United standing, of Tottenham standing, of Chelsea standing at the moment, that they will get in the top four. And that's a real challenge for them. And it's going to be a real challenge for Ineos, because they need the Champions League to be able to really sort of kickstart what they want to do at the club.
Definitely. Well, Ty's led us very nicely into part two there, where we are going to zoom out on the top four race and have a little look at what United might need to do between now and the end of the season to qualify for the Champions League. So do rejoin us in part two in just a moment, where we're going to have a look at the top four battle.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome back to part two of the Manchester Is Red podcast. As I said a few moments ago, myself and Ty are now going to have a little look at the top four battle. And we said we weren't going to try and bring up Sunday after that derby defeat at the Etihad, but we've just got to mention it briefly. That 3-1 defeat to City, of course, Ty, has left United 11 points shy of the top four with 11 games left to play in the Premier League this season. Obviously, Aston Villa won at the weekend. They beat Luton. Tottenham beat Crystal Palace, just to add to United's pain. It's looking like a significantly tall order now for United to finish in them top four spots. Nothing, granted, nothing is impossible, but it's going to require a hell of an effort from here on in.
Yeah, you know, it's not far off impossible. I think it's fair to say it just, you know, it's so hard to see how this team finds those 11 points because, I mean, being brutally honest, I think they're fortunate to be sixth the way they've played this season. You know, I think that is generous. I think they're overperforming there. They've Anana's made an awful lot of saves recently. The winning run that they've had, the form they've shown in 2024 has been unconvincing. They've been as open as they've always been. They're just so vulnerable at the back. They give up so many chances. And, you know, there's 11 games of this season to go and their goal difference is minus two. I think Tottenham's is plus 16, Villa's is plus 22. That shows you the gulf. The United are not close to those teams. 11 points is a big difference. That is a big difference in goal difference. And yes, there's still a slim chance, but it's going to require, I mean, maybe fifth will be enough to get in, but I still think it's hard to see fifth happening. Tottenham have got a game in hand now. I think that would make it 8 points clear for Tottenham in fifth. It's hard to even see that gap being closed, I think, because you look at United at the moment and you look at the rest of their fixtures and you can't see them winning enough games. I mean, they'll probably have to win maybe 9 of the 11, 8 of the 11 and 3 draws or something like that maybe to make up that gap. I just don't see it happening. Something significant is going to have to change. And I know Ten Hag's been saying we've been in form this year. He said it before the derby, but you know they really haven't. And he can't truly believe that because yes, they've got results, but they've got results purely because Anana was making saves and Hoyland was scoring goals, two things that weren't happening in the autumn. You know, I don't think any of the fans who watch them, anyone who watches them regularly, is seeing a huge difference in performance between kind of September, October, November, December and what they've seen recently. It's just that two key players at either end of the pitch have stepped up and delivered and that's made a massive difference.
Yeah, definitely. And as I actually said to you only last week, probably that four-game winning run that they had in the league, it was only really against Wolves in the first half where you watched it and thought, they look a really good team here. They beat West Ham 3-0. That really wasn't a 3-0 game. They conceded something like 22, 24 shots in that game. They were fortunate, I thought, away at Aston Villa with Scott McTominay getting that late winner. Luton, they pushed them every step of the way right till the very end. So like you said, they've not really been, aside from Hoyland's goals and Onana's saves at the other end, they've not been that convincing. And when you look at the statistics, they've scored the same amount of league goals this season as Luton Town. That is a major concern because when you think back to last season, United's third place finish, a lot of it was built on their defensive solidity, didn't score enough. Hoyland coming in felt like it was going to give them a little bit of a lift to sort of balance each other out, sort of be stable defensively and improve their attacking output. But of course, it's not been the case, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. You know, they haven't scored anywhere near enough goals. They've certainly improved of late with Hoyland in the team. And I think, you know, he deserves credit for the way he's kind of kicked on once he's got that first goal. They do look, they look like they've got goals in them with Hoyland in the team. And that has made a difference. But there wasn't enough before then. I don't think it was a surprise to anyone that he started slowly, given he is still pretty inexperienced and pretty raw and had never, you know, he'd never shouldered the responsibility of leading the line for a team like United. Nowhere even close to that. So I don't think it surprised anyone that he started slowly. And then you add to that the defensive record, which is horrendous, really. You know, last season's success was built on a very good defensive record, looking very solid, and having a forward scoring 30 goals in a season. And neither of those things has happened this year. The defensive record has been, it's been awful. It's not just defensive record. It's we talk about it every week, but it's the number of shots they give up, the number of chances they give up. And, you know, to go back to it to last week, I know Ten Hag took offence to it, but I think that was a classic diversionary tactic. I think Ten Hag knows full well that Jamie Carragher's analysis on last week's Monday Night Football was spot on, that the tactically the team is a mess. They're just too easy to play against. The midfield is too easy to play against. The structure's all wrong. Players are getting caught ahead of the ball too often. They're being counter-attacked on too often. And I think, you know, the weekend was the ninth game in a row in all competitions now where they've conceded 15 shots or more. And it's just, you know, it's just nowhere near sustainable. And you know, I'm going to break the rule again by talking about the derby here, but, you know, you listen to Ten Hag after the derby and say it's fine margins. I mean, it's really not. And this is, you know, we're going to come on to the future, but he's got to start talking and behaving like a United manager, because he was basing that win in the derby, he's talking fine margins. He basically wants every shot United have to go in and City to have 27 shots and miss the target and miss all of them. I mean, that is not fine margins. That is a fluke. What he was aiming for was a fluke. And that's just, you know, that is not sustainable.
No, definitely not. And I actually wrote a piece prior to the Fulham game nearly a couple of weeks ago when reflecting on that, sort of looking at it as a game where United really should be winning. And obviously it was a bit like the Bournemouth game at home, a bit like Crystal Palace at home, one of those where they should have been getting a convincing victory and they were beaten. But when you look back at the 3-0 win over Everton at Goodison Park, the 3-0 win over West Ham, I think they conceded 46 shots across those two games. Mm. They got away with it. They were very fortunate away at Everton, really. Everton in that first half, they battered United. But I think when you look at this coming weekend, with it being Everton again, United, obviously, they've got to win this one. They've got to get back on track after back-to-back league defeats. Villa play Tottenham to add a little bit of spice to it. Both could drop points. One of them, of course, guaranteed to drop points. It's, even if United win, it's not going to make up a massive amount of ground. But if they can just eat a little bit into that prospect, it gives them half a chance. So this weekend, especially with it being United's final league game before the international break, this feels like a massive game potentially for Erik ten Hag's future.
Yeah, it really does. They've just got to win it. And really, they've got to win it well and try and get back to a positive goal difference. And like you say, if they do win it, then they know at least one of the teams above them is going to come back to them, that the ideal scenario would probably be a draw. And if it is a draw and United have won and it's 9 points in 10 games, suddenly you're thinking, okay, yeah, maybe there's half a chance there. It's not as, you know, it's not as daunting, it's not as difficult, but they do need to win. They need to try and turn in a convincing performance, and they need to put together another winning run, really, and ideally one that's more convincing. But I mean, you look at the fixtures after this weekend. It's Brentford away, it's Chelsea away, it's Liverpool at home. Really, you'd want to string together maybe 3 wins and a draw, maybe 4 wins, but it's just hard to see it at the moment. And until they do that and close this gap to maybe 5 or 6 points, then I think we're going to continue talking pretty negatively about the prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Erik ten Hag, obviously, he's under pressure. We know that. Samuel, our colleague, did a story last week saying that there was uncertainty surrounding his position at the club. Ineos are understood to have analysed potential replacements. Roberto De Zerbi, somebody of interest. But with the international break coming up, United have got, obviously, back-to-back home games coming. Everton in the Premier League, Liverpool a week later in the FA Cup. The FA Cup represents United's only chance of winning anything this season, potentially salvaging the season. Is it potentially, can this coming week be dubbed as Ten Hag's biggest week of his United Premiership?
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah. I think we're probably at the stage where every week is like that. If it even matters, I mean, it might be that Ineos have already made their mind up. But if he was to win the FA Cup and somehow finish fourth, you know, I think they'd probably find it difficult to sack him, certainly because, you know, the match going fans haven't turned on him at all, really. I think they've got doubts, and, you know, they can see the same things we're seeing, but there's no real sign of dissent in the stands at all beyond just not being there at full time on Saturday and things like that. There's no, you know, there's no real match day negativity towards Ten Hag. And I think he retains a lot of support for some of the things he's done off the pitch as much as anything. I mean, he won the Carabao Cup last season, was very successful, but it's the way he's approached things like Ronaldo, like Sancho, like Rashford. You know, he's kind of restored this idea that the manager should be the most important person at Manchester United. So I think he holds some credit for that. But yeah, I just think there's too many concerns to stick with him. And unless he does somehow get back in the top four and win the FA Cup, then I don't see it. And I wrote a piece in the week there. You know, he's a shorter price to be the next manager to lose his job in the Premier League than United are to win the cup, or United are to get in the top four. And I think that says everything about where we are here, because, you know, Ineos have come in and Ratcliffe's come in and laid out this grand ambition. And, you know, I think some of Ratcliffe's public talk has probably been too ambitious or too kind of not incendiary, but, you know, saying things like we're going to knock City off their perch in 3 years. I don't think that's A, realistic or B, that helpful. Everyone wants to hear that kind of ambition, but you know, it just feels a bit too much, really. But it's clear they do have a lot of ambition for the club. But then they look at the way United are playing in these games, and even, you know, even the Liverpool game, they got a result in the Liverpool game. They got a draw. It was not a sustainable performance. Liverpool have 34 shots, and United have approached Liverpool away and City away this year like a championship team, to be brutally honest about it. You know, they haven't approached those games as anything near equals. It's purely try and survive. And you know, they're three shots weekend. No Premier League team has had less in a game against City this season. And what we're on there, 27 games for City, I think, 26, 27 games. That is so damning that even Sheffield United in their two games against City have had more shots. And when you've got a new owner who spent more than £1 billion to have 25% of this club, he's talking about what it means to him personally. There's no unity between that kind of ambition and then the performance United put in at City, and then the way the manager talks about it afterwards, as if this is a game we could have won. You know, it wasn't 1 in 100 that United win that game on the stats. It was 1 in 1,000, and the ambition on the pitch and from what the manager is saying just does not match what Ratcliffe is saying, and that is Ten Hag's biggest problem at the moment.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, because you've made a good point actually about it looking like a championship team, almost in the FA Cup, going to one of the Premier League's elite away from home and sort of thinking if we can be tight, maybe hit them on the break, we've got a chance. That is not the team that Manchester United supporters want to see. They want to see a Manchester United team in the faces of their rivals, getting at them, going for them. And at Liverpool and at City, yeah, granted, you've got to take a bit of a cautious approach at times, but they were just, it was men against boys for the most part in that game on Sunday. But I think for United now, of course, one of the biggest issues this season, and Roy Keane mentioned it actually after the game on Sunday, is the sense that United have slipped up too often in the games they should have been winning. You think back to the defeats to Fulham, to Palace, Bournemouth, Brighton as well. And then, of course, they only sneak past Sheffield United and Burnley away from home by one goal each. Those two are still to come at Old Trafford, Sheffield United and Burnley. They've still got to go to the likes of Brentford, still got to play the teams to some of those in and around the bottom half of the table. These are the games that United have simply got to win. I did a piece on it earlier this week saying that these are the games they've got to win if they're to stand any chance. Even Chelsea away looks like a game they're going to have to try and win. Mm. They've still got Liverpool and Arsenal at home to come as well after the international break. So United, like you said, they could easily need 8-9 wins from these last 11 games just to stand any chance, even without what Villa and Spurs do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the problem at the moment is that you look at every game, every fixture for United, you know, maybe with the exception of those two home games against Sheffield United and Burnley. Beyond that, you look at every one, and it's very easy to make a case for them not winning these games. You know, we all saw that stat on Monday Night Football about only Sheffield United, Luton and West Ham have had more shots against them this season. I've just said about the number of games where teams have had at least 15 shots. I mean, they've got Everton this weekend. They should beat Everton at home, but Everton were extremely unlucky to lose to West Ham at the weekend. They created so many chances in that game. And, you know, it's not hard to look at that and think if they produce an attacking performance like that again, they'll get chances at Old Trafford, no doubt about it. And they will want, like you say, that United 3-0 win at Goodison was not a 3-0 game on paper. I think Everton had 24 shots or something like it on that day. And even a game like that this weekend, you look at it and you think, yeah, United should win. But if you tell me now that they're not going to win it, I wouldn't be like, wow, that's amazing, what a surprise. I'd just be like, yeah, I can see how that's going to happen already, because it's happened so many times this season. I mean, they've won half the home games in all competitions, and of all of those games, you know, the ones I've just mentioned, Brentford away next, not an easy place to go. You know, you'd maybe say you feel like they're outsiders already for that game. Chelsea, who knows what you're going to get with Chelsea. Liverpool at home in the league, you wouldn't give them much of a shout, really. So it is just a case that the way they're playing, you look at every game and you just can imagine a way they don't win it. And like I say, if you tell me now, you know, by the way, United are going to lose this weekend, or you're going to draw at home to Everton, I'd just be like, yeah, okay, I can see that. You know, if you tell me City have got Everton at home and they're going to lose, I'd be like, I'm going to watch that game, see how that turns out. With this one, I'd just be like, yeah, I can see already how it's going to happen. And that's kind of the situation we're at with United, where every game suddenly looks like, you know, a potential banana skin.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And it does sort of lead into the question of, it depends which United turn up. I think that is the thing. You just do not know what you're going to get. Michael Owen said something after Sunday where he said if he was asked to describe United's style of play, he said, I genuinely wouldn't have a clue what to say. Yeah. And I think that's been the biggest gripe for a lot of fans this season, in the sense that the performances, even though the results haven't been good at all, performances at times have been even worse. They've been so lacklustre and lifeless. But I think for United now, obviously, Saturday against Everton, early kickoff, it's a must-win game ahead of Villa and Spurs going toe-to-toe. But then you look further down the line, like you said, Brentford away, that could go either way. Bournemouth away, that could go either way as well. So it really does feel like the home games are going to be so important. But knowing United, you wouldn't put it past them, say, to lose to Everton and then beat Liverpool in the FA Cup the week after.
No, it's certainly plausible. You know, there's been moments this season where they have produced those, you know, those big wins, those good wins. You think of the Chelsea home game, where, you know, they were fueled kind of by anger, really, and by banning Aslott from Carrington the day before. The Villa game at home, the Wolves game, I guess, you know, but so many of these have proven to be false dawns, really. And that's kind of the problem. And they badly need Hoyland back. I think it was, you know, it was 3 weeks, coming 2 weeks ago. So I'd imagine this is too soon for him, but maybe Liverpool, there'll be a chance he's fit for. They could certainly do with Martinez back. They could do with a left back back. And, you know, it is fair to say that Ten Hag's hands have been tied a little bit by injury this year. I mean, it's been incredible, the number of injuries United keep getting. But really, you look at that team at the weekend and you'd only have Martinez, Shaw and Hoyland in there. It's probably eight of the starting 11 that Ten Hag would pick if he had everyone fit and available to him. And like you say, it should be the case that whoever is fit and available, you have a clear style of play. It's not a comparison United want to hear, but you look at Liverpool recently, you've had loads of injuries. They're playing more kids than United are at the moment. And in that time, they've won a trophy, they've stayed top of the league, they've won 4 games out of 4, and United have 3 players out, and they still look, they don't look like a team. Like you say, there's no obvious style of play. And the best description I've heard of it this year was in the Tottenham game, actually, when they drew 2-2 at home, which wasn't a bad result. I was watching it back afterwards, and Gary Neville described them as United players get the ball. Tottenham players get the ball, and they make a pass straight away. They don't even need to look, because they know what their patterns of play are wherever they are on the pitch. United players get the ball and you can see them lift their head up to look who's available, because they don't know where the teammates should be, because there is no obvious patterns of play. It isn't, you know, with Tottenham, it's happening like that, basically. It's one pass, right, I've got the ball here. I know where so-and-so should be. I know where Bentancur should be. I know what run Son's going to make. It's all pretty much pre-programmed. With United, even when a player gets the ball in space, it's almost like they're stopping and they're putting their head up and going, right, who's where? Because there's no, it isn't second nature to them. And for whatever reason, I mean, you've got to think that's mostly the coaching, that there just isn't, that there aren't those patterns of play. And you just, you know, I've been saying from the start of the season, you can close your eyes and you can picture what a City goal or a Liverpool goal or a top Tottenham goal looks like, really. You know how they're trying to score a goal. With United, you just don't really know how they're trying to score a goal. You can't picture the standard United goal, or you can't picture the United goal that says, you know, the goal they score that says, right, that's what we want to do. That's our style of play. I couldn't tell you what it is, really. And I think that says everything about the fact that, like I say, you can't describe their style of play because it doesn't really feel like they have one.
No, you're quite right. And I think that just sort of leads into the point of where you've mentioned with Tottenham. Ange Postecoglou, who's not even been in the job a year yet at Tottenham, and they've got a clear identity, a very entertaining team to watch for the neutral, really enjoyable team. Brighton as well, the same under Roberto Di Zerbi. So it does present question marks about the coaching methods being implemented at Old Trafford. Of course, quite rightly, Erik ten Hag has mentioned the injuries. You've got to account for that. They have lost key players for all of the season. You can't ignore that fact, but there's still enough talent on that pitch to get an understanding, to get a cohesion, and to be putting performances together that sort of resemble Manchester United standards.
Yeah, there are, absolutely. And I think, I've been saying it since, it felt visible on pre-season tour that Ten Hag tried to take this team on. You know, last season's team wasn't really a classic Ten Hag team. Like I say, it was excellent defensively, loads of clean sheets. Martinez and Casemiro were brilliant. Rashford had the season of his life. And it worked. It got them results, and fantastic. But it felt this preseason like he tried to take it on a level. They tried to press more aggressively, and it almost felt, and it still feels like he tried to make them into Ajax, basically, what his Ajax team were great at. But that Ajax team basically played the game in the final third because they're Ajax with that level of players, which are just so much better than everyone else in the Eredivisie, and it's just not possible in the Premier League. And I think he's tried to kind of recreate that, and it's just not worked. And for whatever reason, he's either not been able to undo it or not wanted to undo it. And you kind of see that. You see that with Antony. Antony's, when you're playing the game solely in the final third, and Antony's getting the ball in the final third, he can do some damage. That's where all of his goals for United have come from, when he's being given the ball in the final third of the pitch. When you're giving the ball on halfway, he hasn't got the game to do anything with it there. And this is kind of like, that's what Ten Hag wants, but the team just aren't capable of delivering it. They aren't of the standard to deliver it in the Premier League. And this is partly why I think you're seeing so many midfielders caught ahead of the ball. You know, to go back to that Monday Night Football analysis again, but you see it every week, the number of players sprinting back into position when they're caught out. And we see it with the corner setup. I mean, one of the abiding memories of this season for me will be the goal that Wolves scored to make it 3-3. And obviously United went on and won that game. But that was, I think that was the 95th minute with seven added on, and United had a corner and they conceded on the counter-attack. And as soon as, I can't remember who passed it to Neto, but whoever had it in the centre circle, it was 2-on-2 or 3-on-2 for Wolves. When United are away from home in the 95th minute, protecting a one-goal lead, and as soon as whoever picked it up in the centre circle, I just turned to Samuel and said, how are they getting counted on? How is this happening? And, you know, they go and score from that. And it was just like, that, you know, that just cannot and should not happen in the Premier League. It's beyond belief that 3-2 up in the 95th minute in a Premier League away game, you're allowing yourself to be counter-attacked on from a corner. You know, it's just the most basic stuff. And that kind of sums up, I think, where things have been going wrong this year.
Yeah, definitely. It is. Roy Keane is quite right, and he says that United play in moments. They do play in moments. There are so many instances where they fail to make games look easy when they should have done, Wolves being the prime example. Well, that wraps up part two of this episode of Manchester City's Red Podcast. Do rejoin us in part three, where we're going to have a quick look at the summer transfer window ahead and what United might be able to achieve ahead of next season. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester is Red podcast for the final part of this episode. Ty, as we've mentioned there, the upcoming summer window is going to be one of massive changes at the football club, both off the pitch and off it. Obviously, a lot of it will depend on if Erik ten Hag is still in the job or not. You raised a very valid point earlier on about sort of saying they need to try and take the control away from the manager of deciding who is coming in, sort of his decision and his alone. But as Samuel reported last week, there is going to be, well, there's certainly planned to be record outgoings this coming summer. And that's where United, certainly for FFP purposes, need to be more streetwise. They've got to be better at it. The likes, say, of Scott McTominay, though he's played a key part of time this season, probably one that doesn't figure in the club's long-term plans. He needs to be moved on. Anthony Martial's obviously out of contract. The likes of Van der Beek, Facundo Pellestri, Jadon Sancho, possibly even Anthony as well. There's a lot of work for Ineos to do in shifting players out this summer, but it's not going to be easy.
No, it's definitely not. And that, you know, they do have to get rid of some of those players. I mean, McTominay is probably the most sellable asset. And in FFP terms, he's the one that would make the biggest difference as well, because he's an academy graduate. So you're selling for 40 million. It's 40 million pure profit. Martial is obviously going to leave on a free. Maybe Varane will leave on a free. You know, that would get a decent chunk of wages off the books. And I think the wage bill is part of the reason that they've struggled so much with these spending rules in the Premier League's financial rules. Other than that, you know, Sancho, it's a difficult one to judge on Sancho, because you'd have to say at the moment it's probably likely there's going to be a new manager. Will they give Sancho another chance? You know, you've got to remember it's not just Ten Hag that Sancho is annoyed here. You know, I don't think it's the case that it's a clean slate when Ten Hag goes. It might be that the club gives him another chance, but I think he's got a lot of making up to do. Van der Beek, I mean, it already feels like there's just no chance of Eintracht Frankfurt taking that option on him. But they have got to trim the squad. The squad, I know it's been stretched recently, but the squad is too big, really. And especially if they get in the Europa League next season instead, or even the Conference League, they, you know, just play the kids, really, in that. I mean, we've seen, if anything, this season, at least we've seen that there are some good youngsters coming through. So give them a chance. You know, you mentioned Anthony there. I mean, I just read a piece for lunchtime, actually, that I don't see them selling him, because I don't think they can. When, you know, you look at the way that these fees are spread out now in terms of FFP and how they look on Premier League accounts. I mean, United sold Anthony for 86 million over 5 years, which means they still, on their balance sheet, they still owe 52 million on that transfer. So if they were to sell him for 32 million, that's 20 million they've lost, really. That's a £20 million impact on this summer's transfer budget. So they can only sell him if any club offers more than 52 million, I think. And, you know, spoiler alert, it didn't happen. You know, there's no chance that any club is going to pay 50 million for Anthony. So they're in a position, really, where I just don't think they can sell him, because you sell him for 20 million. It's essentially costing you 30 million in this year's accounts to actually get rid of him. I mean, it's an incredible position they're in, really. The only way they could do it is through a swap deal, I guess, or something like that. But I think Anthony will get another chance at United, purely because I just don't think financially they can actually sell him, which is, you know, a strange position to be in, really. But beyond that, they have certainly got to try and sell this summer. And I think they're going to need to sell someone like a McTominay at the very least, maybe even Harry Maguire, just to, you know, give themselves that kind of that boost in the transfer market and boost to the budget, especially if they end up finishing sixth or lower.
Yeah, absolutely. McTominay, of course, was a player that United were certainly considering to sell last summer. West Ham obviously were actively interested. And I believe, if I recall it right, I think Samuel reported that it was £40 million that United were going to demand minimum to let him go. And obviously, he's done quite well this season. Obviously, he's chipped in with, I think it's 8 league goals over in the Premier League, a couple of others elsewhere. And he's done a good job and popped up in key moments. So in a way, it's possibly worked to United's advantage in the sense that he's been retained for this season, his stock's risen, so they might even possibly want to get 50 million for him with the way the modern market is.
Yeah, quite possibly. Like you say, in front of goal, he's had a pretty good season. I mean, there's an irony there. In a way, it sums up United's season that Maguire and McTominay were the two players they were pushing out in the summer. You know, Maguire, they accepted an offer from West Ham. West Ham wanted McTominay, Bayern Munich wanted McTominay at one point. You know, they had United got that 40 million or close to 40 million offer, they would have sold him. Had Maguire wanted to go to West Ham, he would have gone. Both have had good seasons in amongst the carnage of a terrible season, really. I mean, if you're doing player of the season, I think there's an argument they're both in the top five, really, for player of the season. And that just kind of sums up the way United's season has gone, really. But I still think there's maybe a chance both go. Like I say, I think McTominay, arguably, it just makes sense to sell him this year, because you kind of have to. I mean, I think it's a different discussion, but this is a problem with these Premier League financial rules and the way these fees are amortised, that you're basically encouraging teams to sell academy graduates. You've seen it with Chelsea and Conor Gallagher. They've got to sell Conor Gallagher to try and bank £50 million pure profit. I mean, to be in a position where clubs are basically being encouraged to sell academy graduates, I don't think is a great position to be in, really, and is a reason to really look at them. But while that is the case, there's a good chance if someone like that would go. And Maguire as well, whose fee has pretty much been paid off now, I think, since he signed. And he's another that, I mean, it feels like there's probably going to be a lot of change at centre-half this year if Ferran goes, but Maguire's had a good enough season that someone would definitely come in for him again, at least at West Ham, if not more. You know, I think he's proven that he remains a very, very good Premier League defender. So there's a chance that as good as both have been this year, they might still be on the market again in the summer.
Yeah, quite easily. But I think you're right there. Maguire, he has been a ray of light through the dark times, shall we say. But I think for United, obviously, they've identified key areas that they do want to look at. And it's a lot of areas. The fullback area certainly need work. Right back debate, obviously, Dalot certainly moved ahead of Wan-Bissaka now. There's obviously a question mark about the left back situation with Luke Shaw getting more and more injuries as this season's gone on. Malacia, obviously, he's not kicked a ball all season. Centre half, there does seem to be sort of a need for a restructure there. Certainly, if Varane goes, Martinez is sort of the only player that you'd sort of say is guaranteed a long term future at Old Trafford. So it could be a centre back where a lot of work needs to be done, more than anywhere else. And then obviously central midfield as well, with replacing Casemiro, because like you said earlier on in this episode, Kobbie Mainoo feels like he's a mainstay in that team now, as sort of the free roaming number 8, can do a little bit of everything. Fernandes is the number 10. They need that new number 6 to complete it. So it feels like potentially centre half and the central defensive midfield position could be the two they need to do the most work in. But obviously FFP will restrict them, and potentially, of course, Champions League qualification as well.
Yeah, you know, it's probably going to be the case that they can't do everything they want. I think you're right that another centre half is going to be a priority. I think they need another striker. You know, they've only got Højlund there. They've not really had Martial all season, and they're not going to have him next season. It feels like they've got to get another striker. You'd say a right back. I mean, obviously they're interested in Frimpong at Bayer Leverkusen. I think maybe Wan-Bissaka. I mean, they only took the option on Wan-Bissaka's contract, which probably said a lot, really, and only have a year left in the summer, so maybe they look to sell him. But yeah, there's probably four positions there that you'd say they would like to strengthen in: a centre back, a right back, a holding midfielder, and a striker, maybe. But how easy that would be to do, you know, we will wait and see. I think it's going to be a tricky summer for them looking ahead.
Yeah, definitely. And just lastly, you've mentioned there about the need for a striker. It is obvious, of course, that they do need somebody to provide support and competition for Rasmus Højlund, because Anthony Martial's out of contract. He's going to go. There's no doubt about that. They've been linked in the national media with Sporting Lisbon striker Victor Gyökeres this week. Reported release clause of, I think, £86 million. United just are not going to pay that for a player to become Rasmus Højlund's backup option. Victor Gyökeres wouldn't want to come to sit on the bench, but it makes you wonder if United maybe last summer could have looked at somebody like Victor Gyökeres when he was still at Coventry City and was sold for something like £22 million. Could be more feasible as a backup option. He might have been more willing to come to a team like United and be that backup striker. Whereas now, Højlund was signed for the future. He is the main man. It's going to be hard to convince any striker to come and sort of say, you're not going to play every week, you're going to be there just in case.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. And they, you know, Højlund's done so well that they probably don't need to spend £80 million on a striker. It needs to be someone maybe in the £25, £30 million mark. And I still think there'll be enough games. I mean, Højlund is raw enough and young enough that he will be taken out of the team at times. I mean, that was the plan this season, that he wasn't going to play every time. I mean, what Ten Hag really wanted in the summer was a Kane and a Højlund. And Højlund would have been kind of the backup option. And, you know, Højlund's done brilliantly recently, but it is still only what he scored in 6 successive Premier League games. You'd still want to see it over a longer period, just to know for absolute certainty that he is ready to start. I mean, what Ineos are trying to build here is a team capable of challenging for the title. And is Højlund that man capable of leading the line? I mean, if you'd be leaning towards probably at the moment, but it's still only a fairly small body of evidence to suggest so. So I think you still need another decent striker who can take the burden off him, who can come in and can challenge him and push him, really. You know, you need someone of a similar level, I think, at the moment. Because it's not a situation where Tottenham were looking for a backup for Kane. I think if you bring in a pretty decent striker, a pretty good striker, they'd probably look at it and think, I can force my way into the team ahead of Højlund. And that is probably what he needs, really, a bit of competition where the two push each other on.
Indeed, it's certainly something United have got to look at. But of course, finances and other priorities elsewhere within the squad will, of course, dictate how things go. But that does mark the end of this episode of the Manchester Is Red podcast. A big thank you to Ty for joining me this Wednesday lunchtime. As always, if you've enjoyed listening to this episode, you can download it from your preferred podcast provider, or alternatively, you can watch us as well on YouTube. Just search for Manchester Is Red. As ever, we'll be back with another episode on Friday where we'll look ahead to Saturday's game against Everton. So take care and we'll see you again very soon.